This time, Scotland 78, how Ali's tartan army got to the brink of rescuing World Cup ignominy.
And it's no nay never, no nay never no more, cause I'll stay a while to over, forever and more. And it's no nay never, no nay never no more, cause I'll stay.
Hello and welcome to By Far the Greatest Team, a podcast in which football fans attempt to decide once and for all who is the greatest football team of all time. Sometimes, like when Brian Clough confidently says he's the best manager in the game, greatness is assured. Other times, Christian Groh shows you his travel card and a different fate awaits. My name's Graham Dunn, desperately checking Oxford United Scottish legends as we speak. And joining me as ever is my fellow self-appointed arbiter of football greatness, Jamie Rooney.
Graham, hello again. Great to be in your company doing this once more time. Christian Groh is a great reference. I do remember the intrigue of Christian Groh and the pride that he showed with his travel card. You can't, I mean, that was only, what, 15, 20 years ago. You can't imagine any Premier League manager ever coming to a club via the metro these days. It's just unheard of. It's a different world. Bring back Christian Groh.
He was a special talent. And delighted to join us. We are going to look at the Scotland 1978 team, the Ali McLeod team. And we're joining us this week, we have Stefan Shaw. Hi, Stefan.
Hi, Graham. Hi, Jamie. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, good. Now, as I was saying in the introduction there, I was desperately trying to think of a good Oxford United Scottish player. I'm sure there must be one. I'm really, really struggling. We had Derek Lilly played for a couple of years, but this isn't someone who's troubling the troubling the schoolbook of great Scottish football legends.
No, you had Jamie Mackie, didn't you? Recently?
Oh, Jamie Mackie.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, no, he's definitely good. He would definitely count. But it's interesting, going back to that, as you will, the 78 team, that was a time when Scottish players playing in England were almost the dominant force.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure we'll come on to the squad in a bit of detail later, but if you look at the teams where Scotland drew the talent from, it's amazing, really. You know, you've got European champions, Liverpool, Manchester United, three players from them, three players from Nottingham Forest, who just won the league in England as well. I mean, it's quite impressive. Particularly if you look now, when we're really struggling to have any sort of Premier League players at all in the Scotland team.
The one I always remember coming down was Frank McAvenny, when he came down to play for West Ham. Was he St Mirren and then St Mirren to Celtic or the other way around? When he came down was the bit where there was a TV strike, and so it was the one time there were no pictures of any, and I think McAvenny scored like in his first 10 games, and no one knew who he was.
Yeah, and I think that was the season that, I don't know if West Ham finished second, but they were certainly second for most of the year, weren't they? McAvenny and Tony Cotty, yeah.
That's correct, yeah. They finished, they were competing with Liverpool and Everton that season, yeah, during the peak years of Everton and the great Liverpool teams as well.
It's a proper dream team. Now, obviously we did the podcast on St Etienne 2 or 3 weeks ago, who got to the Champions League final, which was played at Hampden Park. And oh, you don't really sort of think about that, but it was a big thing in Scotland at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a massive thing for some reason. Yeah, I mean, I guess it was 1976 that was, and it was, I mean, no one had ever heard of St Etienne, to be honest. Well, I hadn't. But yeah, we had a school assembly where the headmaster, you know, he was getting us all kind of G'd up for it, and very much, pretty much everyone in Glasgow was going for Levert, you know, because support the underdog. As you say, another connection in that last pod as well was the Panenka penalty as well. I guess it's all leading quite nicely into the sort of 1978 qualifying campaign, really.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we are going to look this week at Scotland 1978. I love this story, and I've been very keen to look at this, not partly because this particular World Cup is sort of quite etched on my memory. It's probably one of the first ones, well, definitely the first one I've had any awareness of. But it's not necessarily because this, I mean, we can have the debate about whether this is Scotland's greatest ever team. And it's not even necessarily that this is the closest that Scotland ever got to qualifying at one of these tournaments. But I don't think there's another story that sets the narrative of what becomes Scotland at big tournaments from this moment on, which is this weird combination of a bit of self-destruction, a bit of glory, and a bit of glorious failure. It sort of seems to sum everything up, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think probably, yeah, you probably need to go back to 1974, really. I mean, I think that's an important part of the story because there was a great feeling, I think, with that Scotland team, who were a really good team, that they were just so unlucky. You know, they went out without losing a game. I think they went out on goal difference. And I think before 74, I mean, 74 was the first time they qualified for ever, maybe.
Yeah, first time.
So there was no great expectation then, but the team did so well. And I think probably that kind of built up the momentum, if you like, or euphoria, whatever, that probably all stemmed from there. You know, if you even look at some of the home internationals, Scotland 1976 was the first time that they'd actually, I think, won the home international since 1967. And it's one of the Scotland games I can remember very well. But it's the one, I think, where Dalglish hits the ball through Clemency's legs. I don't know if you guys remember that one. And so then, the team was starting to build then. Then 1977 was obviously the famous match at Wembley, where Scotland famously won and then took half of Wembley home with them, really. So it was definitely building. And I think that sort of late 70s, mid to late 70s, I think Scotland were probably objectively looking, even, you know, from a non-Scottish perspective, probably were the dominant force in British football at the time.
That 74 team is a cracking one, because actually it's got a fascinating group, because obviously you've got Brazil who is some time at, and we've got the fantastic Zaire, who we've done on an earlier podcast, who, you know, had to be the favorite team of all time, and I think it's Yugoslavia is the other one in the group there. And to come away out of that, you know, I think it was a creditable 2-0 against Brazil, and I think maybe the only kind of criticism of that team was that they didn't really go hard enough at against Zaire.
Yeah, that's probably true. That was undoubtedly the downfall, because I think, didn't Yugoslavia beat them 7-0 or something?
Yeah, I think it was 8 or 9, actually. I think it's a real strange one, though, because the Zaire story is incredible, Steph, and we've covered Zaire 74. And it almost like it's fate for Scotland. It almost runs through the good or bad fortune that Scotland had through football. Because I think if the fixture list would have been slightly different, as we learned with Zaire, they were protesting over money. So when they played Yugoslavia in the second game after playing Scotland and losing 2-0, they deliberately went out to lose the game. So if the fixture list had been different in that World Cup and Zaire played Yugoslavia, then they had their process over money and Scotland was the second fixture, I think history would have been written in a slightly different way. But I just think it kind of like, it almost feels to me rather unfairly, possibly, and correct me if I got this wrong, but it's just typical Scottish luck when it comes to football. It just doesn't seem to kind of rub their way when it does seem to be rubbing the other way for others.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. It's funny, isn't it? Looking back, just something as simple as the order of fixtures can make a massive difference. You know, there's quite a lot of controversial incidents. I think looking at the Argentina World Cup, because I do remember this as well, that I wasn't allowed to stay up and watch them, because the Argentina matches were always on like 1 o'clock in the morning our time, because they wanted Argentina to play after everyone else so they knew what they had to do. Things like that, you know.
Yeah, there's a little bit of suspicion going on there.
Yeah, I think the first time I really saw Argentina was in the final, because, like I say, I wasn't allowed to stay up to watch them.
Yeah.
This was a bit strange, but yeah.
That 74 performance was really strong. And I guess would Dennis Law still have been playing then?
Yeah. Yeah, Dennis Law was in there, definitely. Billy Bramman.
Dennis Law and a young Kenny Dalglish.
Yes, I think he was probably just breaking through into the team then. He was still at Celtic. And, by 78, he really was in his prime, though, probably.
Yeah.
He was it really was top drawn. You know, I think that when you look back on like the qualifying campaign, he was a different class, and he probably made the difference, I think.
I think it was more of a sentimental decision to take Dennis Law for his contribution to football and Scottish football in general. I think he was carrying an injury. He was coming to the end of his footballing career, and with Scots to 22, as it was at the time, it seemed a logical reason to take Dennis Law. But unfortunately, the world had seen the best of Dennis Law by the time the World Cup reached Scotland in 74.
So the Scotland embark on that qualification, and they're still managed by Willie Ormond, I think, at the time. Yeah. I just love the old-fashioned qualification kind of rule. So in that instance, they're in a group of three, a qualified group of three, which seems really quite strange. A group three with Czechoslovakia and Wales. But actually, presumably Czechoslovakia are the, I don't know if that tournament was seeded, but, you know, they are European champions, aren't they? And I think Scotland lose the first game, then beat Wales to bring it level. And
crucially as well, Wales beat Czechoslovakia. So you've got around the first three round of matches, because there's only six games, as you said, there's only three teams. Mm-hmm. And all the teams are level on 2 points each after playing each other.
And that's the point that Willie Ormond, I think, he takes over at Hearts, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And cue the entrance of Ali McLeod. Now, I was sort of quite interested in, I think probably you see this all the time now in the international game, where actually the best managers in the game don't end up as national managers. But I think still in those days, you know, the idea would have been, certainly in England at that stage, the best manager would, Bobby Robson took over in 82 or whenever it was. Obviously, Brian Clough didn't for kind of other reasons. But in Scotland, you sort of have had this weird, it seems like a bit of a challenge where you've got a series of fantastic managers, you know, probably the best managers out there, many of whom don't manage the national team, or if they do, for only a relatively short stage. And I think even at that point, their first choice would have been Jock Stein, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right. It wasn't really, I guess, international managers always a bit of a strange one. When you know, when's the ideal time for you to take it, I guess, is the thing, isn't it? Is it, you know, is it on your way up? I think in those days it was probably pretty well paid compared as, I mean, that's certainly the Scotland job. I'm pretty sure it's not half as well paid. If you're in the Premier League, David Moyes or something, you know, he's not going to take the Scotland job, is he? But I think in those days, you know, it probably was on a par. I wouldn't have thought money would have made a massive amount of difference. So, yeah, so Alan McLeod was very much, he'd done obviously good work with Ayr, but, I mean, one year at Aberdeen, and I think that was it, wasn't it? I mean, he took Aberdeen, they won a cup, and they came second in the league. So he did great and brought some good players through. So actually, it probably was, you know, it probably was the up-and-coming manager of the time. And also, the press did, well, at least before the World Cup, they absolutely loved him, because he was rent a quote, wasn't he? He was the guy that would, you know, enthuse these players and the press. Everybody loved him, really.
You could definitely imagine Ali McLeod interviewing well. You could definitely imagine him selling himself.
Absolutely, not just himself, but also the, you know, the whole Scotland team. It kind of made everyone believe, I think. And yeah, I mean, in retrospect, yeah, it probably doesn't look so good. But I mean, I can even remember at the time, just the whole, you know, Ali's tartan army was just. I mean, you know, I guess you guys must have got it in England a bit. Maybe times are a bit less cynical. Maybe you did all get behind Scotland. I don't know. It's the first time I ever remember sort of going into a tournament with expectation, and I've never ever felt that since then at all. So yeah,
it definitely feels, looking back, the whole of the United Kingdom was behind Scotland going in that World Cup. They were the sole British representation. It reminded me a bit, when I've looked back on it, of how the United Kingdom adopted the Republic of Ireland in 1994 after every single home nation failed to qualify for the World Cup in the USA. But looking back for Scotland, there definitely was this swell of joy behind them. And it feels like it was right behind the whole country. And, you know, there's a documentary made as well about the Scotland team before they go to 78, which is, you know, talking their chances up, talking about the greatness of this particular team. So I definitely feel, on reflection, the whole country was behind Scotland. And this was a really big story at the time, you can imagine, in England.
A lot of the players, you know, in the Scotland team would have been household names in England, absolutely, because, you know, you've got George Arden, Kenny Dalglish, you know, Bruce Rea. It's all players that, you know, at least half the squad was made up of English first division players. So they would, and some of them actually were English, really. So the old Anglo-Scottish thing as well. So you'd have been very familiar with it. So, yeah, I think you're right.
I mean, you're absolutely right. That squad becomes, you know, obviously Kenny Dalglish is probably the poster child of it. But beyond there, you have people have been in English football for well established. We've got Martin Buchan and Willie Donaghy and Bruce Rioch and Don Mass and all these guys. But then you also had this Forrest effect, didn't you, where you have John Robertson and Archie Gemmill and Kenny Burns, players or football writers, player of the year. You know, he was player of the year.
I was amazed by that, but yeah, it was. Yeah, so you had Forrest had just won the league, so Liverpool just won the European Cup. So yeah, I mean, great pedigree.
So before we get to the World Cup, we obviously have to talk about the qualification, those two qualification games, the first ones of Ali McLeod. And they get the win at home to Czechoslovakia, which kind of puts them in pole position. And they go into their last game, which is against Wales, away at Wales. But Wales switch that game to Anfield. We had Mark Griffiths on from Wrexham on the pod, and I don't remember whether this made the final edit or not. He was explaining about the, you know, quite a lot of frustration about the number of games that got moved away from the racecourse ground where Wales were pretty unbeatable. it does seem this weird decision to play it at Anfield, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, if you think, even just think about Kenny Dalglish, you know, he scored in front of the cop there, in the crucial game. It seems absolutely crazy. I mean, you know, and obviously quite a lot of connections, certainly, you know, between Glasgow and Liverpool and so on. And it's not far either. It's not, you know, I think Liverpool was completely taken over by the travelling fans. And when I remembered it, watching it at the time, it felt very much like a home game for Scotland.
Yeah, commercial reasons why Wales moved the game. They wanted to maximise the potential because it was being built as a battle of Britain, because either Wales or Scotland, one of those two were going to qualify for the World Cup. So it was kind of built this big battle for Britain. And I think the Welsh FA decided they wanted to capitalise on the potential. And as Stefan mentioned, they scored an own goal because they completely forgot that they would probably be outnumbered, and they were very outnumbered. I think the capacity was 45,000. And I mean, I've read accounts that there was potentially 35,000 Scottish fans inside Anfield that night. So they may have took their money, but they didn't get their World Cup, and they lost on the night. But not without its controversy, Graham, though, was it?
No, it certainly wasn't. The game was there were sort of chances at both ends. I think Scotland, to me, having watched a fair chunk of the highlights, it feels that Scotland were probably created the clearer chances. But you get through to the last 15 minutes of the game or so, and it's still 0-0.
Yeah, so the game certainly ebbed and flowed. I mean, Wales were a pretty good team then as well. They had like John Toshack, Terry Yorath and stuff, Brian Flynn. They were a good team, and a great strip as well. I do remember that very vividly.
The strip
fantastic. Yeah, it's fantastic.
I think it's possibly the best strip there has ever been. I'm really struggling to see a better strip than that. We'll obviously put a picture on the social, but continuing the stripes down the shorts.
Yeah,
it's that attention to detail.
And you're absolutely right. And me and Jamie were talking about this earlier, that I love that. I mean, do you have two better kind of number nines than John Toshack at one end and Joe Jordan at the other? They are proper strikers, aren't they?
Absolutely, yeah. You can imagine corner kicks would have been interesting if they were marking each other.
Well, as it turns out, long throws are quite interesting as well, because he's going to pop up for other reasons. But I was absolutely staggered to see that the long throw is taken by Willie Johnson. I can never remember a winger with a long throw. A winger with a long throw, that never happens, does it?
No, absolutely not. It's a bit of a one-off, I think. I do remember it very well, picturing it. And, you know, it was impossible to tell, really, wasn't it? You know?
It's part of this that I did, I did find what I can only assume is BBC Scotland's commentary on the occasion. And they quite clearly, I think the phrase is, that's as clear a penalty as you'll ever see, decided. But you're absolutely right. It's one that, you know, it's a bit like the 66 World Cup goal, you know, did it cross the line or whatever. The thing about that is you want the footage to zoom closer in. You want to get a different angle of the handball. What's clear is they're both going to punch the ball.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think George Jordan was always a bit coy about it, wasn't he? I don't think he ever admitted or whatever. So, yeah, it was an unbelievable moment. I mean, but I mean, sometimes that controversy is good. I mean, I suppose it's, you know, if it goes for you, then it's great. But it makes the game so memorable, doesn't it? But I guess if you're a Welsh, you'd have probably other opinions.
And then Dalglish gets gets a second to underline the win.
So that penalty that Don Masson took was, you know, the amount of pressure he must have been under to cool this. I think he sent the keeper the wrong way. And that was a massive moment. And then the Kenny Dalglish goal was just absolutely brilliant. I mean, you know, it's that overlapping, wasn't it? Overlapping Martin Buchan, and then fantastic cross, and then who else but Kenny Dalglish in front of the cop, you know, puts it away. I mean, absolutely brilliant.
It's a great. I don't really remember Dalglish scoring headers, but
no,
he obviously can do it.
He's certainly connected with that one.
He absolutely justifies the commentary if it were ever used in that particular moment. He rose salmon-like, because it literally looks salmon-like. It's a fantastic header. It deserves every single syllable of he rose salmon-like.
It definitely does. It's just sort of tying into the, I suppose, some of the hype that follows this. Joe Jordan was obviously a character because of his missing front teeth. I don't remember that there was, I think there was a Heineken advert which had Joe Jordan refreshing the parts the other bit, and it was his teeth in the warm-up was filling in his teeth after he'd had his pint of Heineken. And you're thinking, I mean, that's the level to which they've caught the imagination.
Yeah, absolutely. It was certainly fearsome looking, wasn't it, once he took those teeth out.
Although he showed when he was assistant to Harry Redknapp, I think, when he was at Tottenham, wasn't it, when Gattuso has a go, yeah. Joe Jordan takes his glasses off. It was no more menacing thing. It's just the most statement of intent, and, you know... so Scotland qualifying, Jamie, I mean, you've done a small bit of research around this, because there is actual reason for why Scotland should have some optimism about it.
Yeah, there genuinely is. I mean, there's a couple of things going on here. I mean, the coverage, as we've already mentioned, is pretty high for the Scottish national team. The team are performing to a level where it's plausible that they can go to Argentina and be one of the favourites. And I think they were 10-1 to win the World Cup. I mean, you're in the territory of a France, say, an Argentina, a Belgium in our current day and age. But this predates FIFA rankings. FIFA rankings, which I find useful as a barometer of how you measure where teams are at that particular moment in time, didn't come in until the early 1990s. And shortly after that, we had the ELO rankings, which is based on chess rankings, and they're slightly weighted differently, but they mean the same. What they do, they kind of tell you who is the best teams and what position they are ranked in world football. And what ELO have done, they've taken all of the international results from the dawn of time when England and Scotland first kicked off in the 1800s and the international football was born, right through to the current age. So we can tell where Scotland was ranked in 1978 going into this world tournament. And they were ranked as the fourth best team in world football behind Argentina and Brazil, who they'd just played as well the summer before in a warm-up and narrowly lost to Brazil, but acquitted themselves exceptionally well in Brazil and drawn with Argentina, the host of the 78 World Cup that would 12 months later go on and win. So they're ranked fourth in the world. So this is a pretty decent Scottish football team. We've already talked about the quality of the players, but we now know from the ranking, the ELO ranking, they're ranked as fourth in the world. They're a tidy team.
They come at this off the back of, is it successive home international wins, isn't it? But
yeah,
we should probably explain to anyone under a certain age what the home internationals were. But that used to be, that was kind of a high point of football in my early days of following it, which was obviously this end of season 14 tournament between England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. And I think eventually the grudge matches between everyone got too much after a while. Who knew that if you have a series of local derbies played in the summer at the end of the season?
I think England-Scotland used to be like a week after the FA Cup final, didn't it?
Yeah.
It was the last game. And certainly in Scotland, it was a huge deal. I'm not sure it was quite as big in England, but in Scotland, it was, you know, it was everyone would go around each other's house and watch the game together.
the Home Internationals began, just kind of give you a deeper interest, in 1884, and they ran right to 1984. So they're 100 years old in terms of their running. The 77 is marked as Scotland's final championship that they win. They do defend in 76, but then they don't pick up a championship after that. They're kind of distributed between England and Northern Ireland. But the 1977 championship is famous for the Wembley incident. So Scotland taking up most of the Wembley turf, the goalposts, and breaking the crossbar. They beat England at Wembley 2-1 to win the 1977 home championship. And we've got that famous pictures that we've all seen, probably all of us seen, is any, you know, any attachment to football, where Scotland just own Wembley.
Well, that's it. Moving on to the 78, I mean, the momentum was definitely building then, wasn't it? Absolutely. The team just seemed to be getting better and better. And the game against Czechoslovakia, I mean, European champions, that was the moment, I think, where, you know, we could do well here. Absolutely.
You know, it is interesting when Ali McLeod is being in those, when he's being interviewed beforehand, and he's kind of, I'd be disappointed if we don't get a medal. I don't think, I mean, it's obviously partly his style, but I think there is genuine, you know, what you don't really work out is at what point it slips into, not quite arrogant, because you need a degree of arrogance about it, but at what stage it slips into complacency.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, overconfidence, I think. Yeah, that's the danger, isn't it? I think the public were equally as enthusiastic, shall we say, as Alan McLeod was, and the team all kind of fed off each other. You know, even me as a 11-year-old, I was pretty convinced we were going to do well. Really was. But yeah, I have an excuse. I had youth on my side, didn't I? So
that enthusiasm is incredible, because the send off is sensational. It's something that I think is unprecedented in terms of the send off the team are getting. And, you know, they're being called onto the pitch individually at Hampden Park before their big send off, which is fantastic. You're getting the whole nation getting behind the team, and they really are. I mean, when you watch the, you know, the documentaries that have been made afterwards, you know, the brilliant BBC one, you know, A Love Story of 1978, you get a sense of how people in Scotland are really getting behind this team and believing that they are going to win, just like Ali McLeod tells them, we're going to win this thing. And some of the stories of how, I mean, it's 1978 and you've got tens of thousands of, probably more than that, hundreds of thousands of Scottish football fans traveling to Argentina. It's incredible. Some of the journeys and some of the things that those guys and girls did to make that World Cup are extraordinary. They're selling businesses. There's one story where a gentleman flies to New York, and then from New York, he hitches, buses, trains it to Cordoba. Now, that's an 18,000-kilometer journey. If you started that today and you were traveling at an average speed of around about 35 kilometers, that's being a kind of a loose average in 1978, it would take you 22 days to get there. And that's just from New York. So some of the way the country was getting behind them, that they were prepared to put their lives on hold to go and witness this incredible event and prioritize football in Scotland in a World Cup as the biggest priority of their life at that moment, is fantastic.
Those journeys are spectacular. And that's the other thing, because, you know, I think here we are in 2023, you know, it's not easy to get to Argentina now.
No, I like the two guys who'd mapped into South America, and like sort of A4 map, and that's what they used to get all the way from the very, you know, the very north of the country all the way down to Colombia.
Landed in Trinidad and Tobago, yeah. And
they thought that was in South America, didn't they? I mean, it's, yeah, an incredible journey.
But the other thing that did was also remind me, probably one of the things with football being becoming a little bit more cosmopolitan, I think is the word you'd use now, because it did used to be that, you know, European teams could mostly win the World Cup when it was in Europe. I mean, the South Americans, you know, Brazil were good enough, Argentina, they could do it, but European teams couldn't win out in South America. I mean, that was like unheard of. Nobody could do that, and you forget the difference it would be for players playing over there, and certainly. You referenced the Scotland 78 Love Story documentary, and in there you get, you know, it's really clear about the the challenges of the training conditions, the training pitch, the hotel. It, you know, it's a totally different environment there, let alone being so far away from home.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it took Scotland like it took like a couple of days to get there, really.
Yeah.
And by the time they got there, then the local town folk were wanting to greet them and have parties with them and stuff. And they just wanted to crash out. And yeah, some of it is very interesting, like the Scotland Hotel. This must have been before Expedia and stuff, because you know they booked into a hotel, it wasn't even finished yet. You know, there was no carpet. There was no water in the swimming pool. And yes, you see, the training ground was, you know, it was just like some dusty old track somewhere. It kind of shows, I guess, just how sort of naive things were a little bit in those days. But also, I mean, maybe it wasn't completely unwelcome from the host, I suppose, as well, you know, to put some of these obstacles in other teams' ways.
I dread to think what Roy Keane would have made of those training.
Stefan, you make a really good point about the home nation and welcoming the other 15 teams that are joining, because it's another topic for another day, easy. But Argentina were run by the military at this particular moment. It's a dark period of time for not just Argentina, but just for FIFA and its relationships of how it works with certain countries that are hosting World Cups. But there was absolutely a volume of work going on to make Argentina win that World Cup, undisputedly. We've seen evidence of that now. It's easy to kind of point the finger at Scotland's preparation for the hotel and the training facilities, but we don't know in 1978 what information they were getting from the Argentinian, you know, hosts in order to prepare these teams. And it could be that they were just stacking the advantage as much as possible in the hosts. And that was definitely absolutely the case.
You know, the advantage is going to be stacked against you. One thing you might consider doing is watching the opposition teams.
it does seem crazy now, but I mean, Alan McLeod was very much of the opinion that, you know, he would spend his time preparing my team to be as good as possible rather than worrying about the opposition. But yeah, that did seem very underprepared, really, even in those days, because, you know, I'm sure you could easily go and watch Peru to try and work out who was going to take the free kicks, for example. You know, that's one of the stories. Alan Ruff asked one of the defenders, well, are any of these guys good at free kicks? Well, the answer is yes. It's a shortly discovered.
So they do come up in that first game, they come up against Peru, continuing the theme of Scotland playing teams with fantastic kits, another glorious kit, the Peru one, a lovely sash in there. And actually, bizarrely, everything looks like it's going according to plan. Scotland go one up after, I think, 14, 15 minutes. Bruce Rioch scores. But it's certainly what I noticed looking back, and I was too young at the time to really understand much about the debate. At the time, there was obviously a lot of debate about who would play in midfield. He stuck by Don Masson and Bruce Rioch. But they also think it's only one defender plays all three games. He seems to change the defence up every week. And they're obviously, they'd have been missing Danny McGrain. He was injured. And I assume Danny McGrain would have been a first choice in that team.
I think that is true. I can even remember, vaguely remember back about the debate. It was very much the midfield was the shitty stick with the guys who got them through the qualifying, who did such a great job, but who were, you know, they were getting on a bit, and there were certainly signs that they were, you know, could get overrun in midfield, certainly. Or bring in, like, as I say, Graeme Souness, Archie Kemp, we'll bring in the guys who are doing it at the very top level. And I think that was a dilemma McLeod had, really, because Scotland had a terrible home international. You know, England beat them at Hampden to kind of dampen things a little bit. And he played something like 20 different players. You know, he tried to play every player in the squad, I think. It certainly smacks that, you know, you get into the World Cup and you've got three games to go. You really do want to start honing in on your best 11. And I think the problem was that, yes, you know, I don't think McLeod really knew, certainly the midfield, who it was. And I think there was a lot of debate in Scotland as well, absolutely.
Does have a bit of bad luck as well, because Gordon McQueen is establishing himself in that defence at that particular moment. He's just moved recently from Leeds United to Manchester United for $500,000 at the time. So it's a big sum of money. Wow. And he gets injured, and he probably shouldn't have even been taken to the 78 World Cup finals. But I think because the hope for McLeod was, and he was definitely an eternal optimist, this guy, that maybe Gordon McQueen could get fit and could be available to play. So losing him at the beginning is, again, it's one of those kind of like, we're just not getting the rubber things. I mean, injuries are part and parcel of World Cup finals, but when you lose a player that you probably have earmarked to be one of your two centre-backs, it does change your plans a little bit.
And it's fair to say the Peru goals are quite good.
Yeah, I was actually really, I mean, I knew Peru were quite good. You know, from my memory, I thought it was quite an even match and we were really unlucky. But I did look at the highlights recently and Peru were a great team. I mean, three cracking goals they scored. And that Kubilis was, I mean, what a player he was. He went on to be named in the team of the tournament in the midfield. He was absolutely brilliant. And the free kick especially was just, you expect him to use the other foot, really. No matter how many times you see it, he's still amazing.
The free kick is something else. I mean, for anyone who's not seen it, it is literally the last thing you're expecting. I don't think I've ever seen anyone take a free kick and bend it with the outside of their foot the other way around the ball. It's just...
Yeah, and it obviously had been planned in training because one other guy's like runs over the ball, doesn't he? So it was a really good move. It did kind of wrong foot Alan Ruffin, right? So.
It is absolutely in right foot territory. It's the, you know, that kind of in-swinger. Everything says to you that this is going to be... You know, with the right foot, but the way he positions his body is almost good. So you can see why Alan Ruff is fairly confused, but it's genius and it's so precise to kind of go the other side of the wall. And, you know, it's Roberto Carlos-esque almost.
It also sets what, to my mind, becomes very much a theme I largely remember, which is of Scotland at World Cups, which is Alan Ruff being beaten from distance.
Yeah, well, I have to say I have a vested interest because obviously I'm a big Partick Thistle fan and to have a player in the Scotland squad was amazing, really. And not just that, but he was unarguably the first name down in the team sheet. So so no, I'm sorry, but no, I can't agree with you there, Graham. It was a fantastic keeper. And he used to have plenty of practice playing for Thistle, that's for sure.
definitely. So, yeah, I was going to say he must be part of Thistle's
I was looking down, like you say, looking through the Scotland squad, and it's all your top match teams, really. It is like a roll call. The only interesting thing is, yes, you've got a player in there from Partick Thistle, and there was no players from Celtic at all in the squad, which I guess seems surprising, but it was a transitional time for them.
Yeah, that is incredible, isn't it?
Danny McGrain would definitely, you're right, if he had been injured, and he might have made a big difference.
Yeah, a lot of experience there in the defence, certainly. It certainly gave the impression you can, you know, again, Peru, good side, used to playing football in Latin America in that climate. So Scotland seemed pretty underprepared and a bit taken aback by it. It's obviously then made worse by what happens with Willie Johnston at the end of the game. So Willie Johnston gets picked out to do the drugs test afterwards, and he's taking a pill for a cold or so forth, isn't it? Supposedly so. Now, Willie Johnston is a player who wasn't immune to controversy over his career, I guess.
No, I think he'd been banned quite a few times when he played for Rangers. He pretty much, I think, had to kind of move south because he such huge bans, and I don't think that the SFA wanted McLeod to pick him at all because he did have that reputation. I mean, an absolute brilliant winger, but very prone to retaliation. I mean, he got sent off something like 20 times in his career, and I think all of them were for retaliation, pretty much. He was that kind of character. So I think it was quite controversial. McLeod obviously stood by him, but they just certainly didn't, you know, once the scandal broke, they didn't give him any help at all. They basically smuggled him out of the hotel, and then armed guards took him onto the plane, and that was him basically for the next 3 days until he got home.
This is kind of the, and we've seen this, we've certainly seen this at more recent England teams at tournaments where, you know, the hype is so much, it builds up, but the moment things don't go right, and definitely an element that there is so much media attention in Scotland at this World Cup.
Absolutely, yeah. I think the thing is as well, so I think it was one of the first World Cups where the tabloids were sending their news reporters to find stories, whereas previously it'd been very much the sports writers would go along with the teams, and there was that level of trust built up, and you know they would socialise together and all that kind of stuff. But I think this is kind of the start probably of that culture of, yeah, let's try and to get the story on the front pages rather than the back pages type thing.
Yeah, I think that's a really solid point, Stefan, because this goes back to what's going on in Argentina. And it was definitely seen in the Western world as an opportunity to expose that. So a lot of journalists would have gone, as you rightly say, to Argentina, not really interested in the football, but more interested in what else was going on in Argentina so they could exploit that story or bring it to it, you know, bring it to the rest of the world. And I think that's part of the problem for Argentina, because Argentina thought they would host the World Cup and it would generally be a big success story and their way of living and culture would be kind of, you know, transported around the world. But when you invite the whole world press into your country, you're going to be exposed.
That's not going to work out. There's no lessons to be learned.
It really is a solid point that Stefan makes of that, because it's such an important part of what was going on in this particular period.
You're right. It did remind me, Graham, of as you said, I think it was the Germany World Cup when England were in such intense scrutiny all the time.
Yeah, you can see it. It's the moment it turned, you know, so that wave of optimism is great until something doesn't go right, and then the wheels start to come off, and you can just tell by the time now. Now, again, going into the game against Iran, who should really be the whipping boys of that group, again, arguably, maybe watching Iran would have been a useful thing to do before the game. But certainly in that game, you can see it feels like a confusion and a just mentally, then they don't seem in the place, right place to play that game almost.
No, it's a really bizarre game. I remember the time thinking it was a strange one, really. And looking at the highlights again, it is weird because, I mean, Peru 100% underestimated, and actually they were a really good team. Iran, I'm still not really sure what happened there. Obviously the Scotland players were out of sorts. I'm not sure watching Iran before would have made much difference. It was very much a, you know, England-Iceland sort of type performance, I thought. where it's actually, you know, Scotland just played absolutely awful. Like, could not string two passes together. Then it was, it's painful viewing again. I think that's, you know, it's a lot worse than the Peru one for me, really, just because, what went wrong? With that bizarre own goal.
The own goal is fantastic, though, isn't it? It's absolutely, I mean, there's not a Scotland player near. There's about three of them, three Iran players and a keeper. And a ball bouncing around. I can't find a Scotland player in the frame alone.
I think possibly that Iranian player, I've been paying attention to Scotland's British home championships that summer as well, because Willie Donaghy scores a bizarre own goal where there's not a Welsh player anywhere near. So maybe the Iranians did their homework on Scotland for actually this is the tactics we need to adopt. But I think to balance it out a little bit, Iran, I've talked about the ELO rankings. Iran were ranked 23rd in the world at the time. So, you know, that's not a pushover. That's the equivalent of going into the 2002 World Cup of Belgium playing Wales. Now, you would expect Belgium to win that, but you would expect it to be a tough game. And Iran were ranked one place. I mean, one place is very little in FIFA rankings. 20 places could be very little in ELO rankings, sorry. But Iran were ranked one place ahead of Peru. So, you know, Scotland's, for all of its problems, they've still got an opponent that can play football and is in the World Cup finals on its own right.
Yeah, and I think possibly panic has moved on a little bit as well. I think the 3-1 defeat from Peru was just such a big shock to the system that you could just tell the players in the Iran match are just so nervous, even, you know, touching the ball or anything. There's so much pressure now. You've really got to win that game, or else when you're out, really.
Yeah, otherwise you end up, you know, having to go into the last game against Holland, who runners up in the last tournament, they're going to be runners up in this one. They got to the semi-finals of the European Championship. Obviously, you want to get a result against Iran, because what are the chances of you beating Holland by three clear goals?
Exactly. You need some kind of miracle, wouldn't you, really?
And of course, it so nearly happens. Now, he does change the team up. He does bring Souness in, which is seen as a real difference maker. But not to make things difficult for themselves, Scotland go a goal behind. So at this point, you know, the task now is four goals. You know, it's just not on. There's no, you know, and especially when, and we didn't really talk about it, but the sort of famous thing of that Iran game is really the footage of Ali McLeod's body language on the bench, you know, but just sat on the bench with his head in his hands. It's like,
Absolutely. Don't Cry For Me Argentina kind of headline wrote itself, didn't it, really?
Yeah. So you absolutely, you would have no optimism for it really going in there. But this is where Scotland have been subsequently several times, where all hope is lost. And then suddenly it sort of kicks in.
I think, as you said, they started the game fairly poorly. They'll go down and they just, the momentum built. And Scotland get into the game. I think they hit the bar.
Yeah, they got a penalty in half time to level things. No, not a penalty. I think the penalty came in the second half. Another fantastic goal. Yeah, he gets his leg over. It's fantastic. But Scotland, I mean, it's beautiful on YouTube. You can watch the whole game. And I've watched the first half. And Scotland do actually start quite well. They, within 5 minutes, they've hit the woodwork. They've then had a goal disallowed after 7 minutes. And the footage that you can watch on YouTube, it looks a perfectly good goal. And coincidentally, you've got Jack Taylor, who was the World Cup referee in the 1974 World Cup final, sitting on the panel and BBC Grandstand. Yeah, way before Peter Walton was doing it on BT Sport.
Oh, excellent.
You got Jack Taylor giving his views on this. And there's also a second goal disallowed as well. I think Dalglish gets one, Jordan gets one. Jordan should have had a penalty. And this all happens before the Dutch get their penalty and score. But the debate, this is a brilliant part. I encourage you to go watch this. You can watch the debate. You've got Jock Steen, the brilliant Jock Steen, Laurie Mennemy, and you've got this wonderful Jimmy Hill. I mean, obviously he had that beautiful chin, but he's now got this tailored beard that comes and hangs off his chin. He's got the cravat on. He really does look like he's going to go to a jazz concert straight after the footage. He's dressed so well. And whilst Jack Taylor is criticising the referee openly on television, live television, which you can imagine the effect that would have had on how you were feeling emotionally. You feel that you've had a penalty and now you've got a former World Cup referee telling you, yeah, you should have had a penalty. You're going to be going crazy, right? So you're palpable always. And then Laurie McMenemy defends the referee. I won't embarrass myself. I do too many accents on this and I shouldn't do them at all, really. And in his strong Geordie accent, he's like, you know, people make bad decisions. And if you're a good driver and you knock someone over, does that make you a bad driver? He literally uses that as an example. The referee. It's fantastic viewing.
Oh, I'm definitely watching that. So they get their penalty relatively early into that second half for 2-1. Archie Gemmell takes this one. And then I think it is one of the great World Cup goals. I think I struggle to think of many better than this. Gemmell takes out five players with that, really sort of only two moves.
And the bit I remember as well is Dalglish loses the ball, and I can just remember us shouting at the telly in disappointment that Dalglish has lost possession. And then it breaks the game on. And then from then on, even at the time, it seemed like slow motion because it's kind of, the Dutch defenders are really are all over the place, and they're diving in, aren't they? And he's just so calm. He's like he's on a different space, time, you know, sort of whatever. He just takes his time, doesn't he? And I think one of the best bits is right at the end, where he almost pauses and lifts it over the keeper. And it's just such a cool finish. It's just amazing.
Those first couple of touches where, you're right, Graham, he takes out the whole of the Dutch back line. Then he does a wonderful nutmeg. It's gorgeous. And, you know, plants the Dutch defender on his backside. And then, as Stefan's talked about, it is almost like you're watching it in slow motion, because he then starts shaping his body around the ball, his head's up. He's got Dalglish to his left. He could tap it to Dalglish, and Dalglish has got to tap it. But he's in such, as Stefan mentions, he's in so control. His body then tells you know exactly what he's going to do. But by this point, the keeper's already committed. Train spotting did a fantastic job of showcasing how that goal is felt.
I'm glad you got the train spotting reference in before me. It's a classic. Absolutely.
Other than the ultimate disappointment, is actually that that moment of belief. At this point, Scotland only need one more goal, and that the window of belief isn't longer. You know, it's I think it's 75 minutes, Gemmell scores, and then, you know, within 3-4 minutes, is it Johnny Rep?
Yeah, absolute superb strike. Unfortunately, 30 yards or something, wasn't it? And It just absolutely flew in. I don't know, where the Dutch toying with us? I suppose there's always those debates, isn't there? It's a shame, like you say, 3 or 4 minutes of oh, we're going to do it to, oh my goodness, we're not. Reality bites, you know.
Having gone into it with such a high, and being greeted as, you know, this fanfare on the way back. It's a very low key return by the time they come back. And McLeod stays. He stays on for a few months and for another game, but it's clear that
I don't know what that was about. It must have been some contract thing, probably. Yeah, I think he stayed on for the first qualifier, didn't he, of the European Championship. And then he went. I think in total he was only in charge for 17 matches or something.
Yeah.
That seems amazing, really, because it's so memorable. To pack so much in such a short reign is quite amazing.
It is incredible. When you think of Scotland managers, he weirdly is right up there, isn't he? I mean, you kind of remember Craig Brown and you remember Jock Steen. I sort of remember Andy Roxburgh, but I wouldn't have thought, well, maybe. But Andy McLeod is one of the first people you think of.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because it's so memorable. And like I said earlier, it's very much the, you know, certainly in my time watching football, I've never felt so sort of enthused about Scotland's chances whenever they qualify. In fact, now I'm actually, you know, I find that it's almost a mixed blessing, because we're pretty much guaranteed to be also runs, you know, when we get there, which is a bit of a shame, because that centre was the one time where actually we weren't just also runs. We were, you know, we did, you know, we potentially did have a chance realistically.
Do you think this is a step change in Scottish football history? Because you're absolutely right, because Scotland has always had a wonderful reputation in football. I mean, the English get the credit of giving the game, but the Scots very much participated in this from the very beginning. And the Scots are accredited for giving us the passing game. The game changed from that moment. And in 1978, as we've discussed, Scotland were one of the best teams in international football. Their reputation had been strong to that point. Their club sides had been winning European Champions trophies in Celtic just 10 years previously, and Rangers a few years before that. Do you think, and slightly cheeky on my behalf, so forgive me, but you've got the 1978 World Cup theme tune, Andy Cameron, Ali's Tartan Army. You know, you've got a comedian singing this song, this brilliant football song, where you're going to win the World Cup. And then just 20 years later, the 98 World Cup, Delamitri, not a comedian. Just, you know, the official song is just "Don't Come Home Too Soon." Do you think this period in time for Scotland by not qualifying for the second phase of a World Cup is a step change where the reputation starts to change?
It was almost after the 78 World Cup. I mean, everyone was so down in the dumps, so dismal, and not just that, it was quite embarrassing, really. I remember at the time, God, yeah, you know, everybody really was. It was so disillusioned with it all. And then, yes, I mean, Scotland still, you know, that was the second of five consecutive qualifications for World Cups, which is a fantastic record for a relatively small country. But I think with each one that we qualify, probably diminishing returns. And, yeah, it got more realistic, that's for sure, by the time Delamitri came along.
Delamitri, I like to think the brief on that was, we're really after, we want to manage expectations for this, Del.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I might rework that chorus. It is an extraordinary change of fortune. But you're absolutely right. It's kind of, you know, I think actually that Scotland side has created some unbelievable memories, especially that performance against Holland. But they do come back chastened. You know, not for the first time, as we've seen. You know, they're almost, that hype gets too much, and it then creates expectations you can't live up to.
That's right. But you know, it's amazing times, and it's great to look back at it now from X number of years later as well. And yeah, it was good to have had it. That's for sure. Because you know, just to actually have that enthusiasm and you know, and they were a really good team.
So we should come to rank this team's place in history. We have five categories: all-time greats right at the top, true greats, touch of greatness in the middle, edge of greatness, and then the blinkered greats. Oh, this is going to be an interesting one. Jamie, I'll let you go first.
thank you very much. Everything on the surface points towards edge of greatness, but I'm completely dismissing that because I'm going beyond the surface and I'm taking into the context that this was a very good, if not brilliant, international football team. We've talked about the stars that they had playing from European Cup winners, current European Cup winners to be, and a few brilliant Manchester United players as well mixed in with that, and a brilliant Partick Thistle goalkeeper, by the way. So edge of greatness for me would be unfair. They've also, as we've talked about, they've beaten the current European champions, Czechoslovakia, and we've talked about how brilliant that team were in beating the Netherlands and West Germany to win that tournament, that 14 tournament in 1976. I think we could pick holes in the preparation. We could pick holes in the euphoria, but it's a World Cup, and colour TV is in its third World Cup, and TV is becoming the new audience of watching football. So it's completely understandable, that euphoria. We see it all the time for the smallest things now. It's a crazy world, and why you can't blame people for being carried away and getting excited about something. I think everything tells me, as much as I'd want to rank this team as an all-time great, I think the fact that they weren't able to just do that one thing that no Scottish team yet has been able to do and get beyond the second phase, the first phase of a World Cup finals. And I like to think in my lifetime, I will see that. So I'm ranking this team as true greats to get us started, Graham.
Great.
Second
bracket. Stefan, what do you think?
I'm very, very flattered by that, actually. I had very much slightly less ranking. I mean, I would have went probably for a touch of greatness, as in they did touch great heights. Absolutely. That Wales game, I mean, when the pressure was on, absolutely brilliant. You couldn't really ask for a better qualifying game than that. And then, you know, the bittersweet game against Holland, which just, to me, just sums up, that is football for you, you know. Long-suffering fans, you hit these peaks and these troughs, but, I mean, very rarely within 3 minutes of each other. And for all the great players. So for me, yeah, I'm going to, you know, the all-time Scotland teams are definitely the best that I've seen. I would go with, yeah, touch of greatness.
We had, we did Zaire on, and I think me and Jamie both attempted to push Zaire up the food chain. We had Shane was our guest on that one. He said, blinker great, they're the bottom category. No, you can't, they can see it all. And I'm trying to, you know, it is difficult to think of the team that churned out that one all with Iran can have any level of greatness. But the narrative attached to this team is just fantastic. There's a sense of drama throughout everything, right from that qualification stage, which just makes them incredibly watchable. It's weird. And to your point, both your points, this was a really, you know, they were very good players. They had really good players in amongst it. I would definitely say Scotland's best team that they've produced ever. And I just think they're entertainers. I like you, Jamie. I can't go as far as true greats. That's just madness, clearly. But I quite like touch of greatness for Scotland. Quite like touch of greatness. For the smile they can't help but put on your face, I think Scotland 78, Ali's Tartan Army, touch of greatness. So one last thing. We have the opportunity to go back to the time machine, going back to 1978 or earlier, I guess. Jamie, let's start with you. If you could go back to anywhere in that Scotland campaign, the World Cup, well, where are you thinking?
Yeah, I think there's a few obvious candidates that we've already talked about. You could go back to the 77 match at Wembley and witness some incredible history there. You've got the Archie Gemmell goal, which is one of the best, as you mentioned, one of the best goals in World Cup history, quite comfortably, I think. It's definitely in the top 10. But I'm pretty secure where I want to go to. So I'm thinking of the fan that sold his business, that's travelled to Trinidad and Tobago or travelled to New York, and then through this blissful ignorance has decided to hitchhike their way down to Cordoba in Argentina, thinking it would only take a couple of days. It probably turned out to take a couple of weeks, if not more. And they've made this long, arduous journey. I can't imagine the places they would have slept, the food they would have ate in order to make that journey. the consequences of their actions that they're going to have to face when they get back home in July, August. And they've got to Cordoba and they're at the first game, and all of the hype that has lived up to that Scotland team at that point is absolutely believed when Joe Jordan scores that first goal. The relief that fan must have had when that first goal goes in, to think everything we've done has been worth it to this point. It goes a bit pear-shaped after that, as we discussed, but I'd want to go back to that moment and feel the euphoria of what that must have felt like as a football fan, traveling that distance to see your home nation play in a World Cup finals, the other side of the world.
Yeah, I like that. Stefan, where would you want to go back to?
That's a great answer, I have to say. That's brilliant. I mean, I had the only candidates are kind of the obvious one. The Dalglish goal against Wales was brilliant. One thing we haven't mentioned here, there was a turning point in that match. I don't know if you watched the highlights, and that's when Alan Ruff does a great save from Toshak. He tips the ball onto the bar. And that, to me, that was the turning point of the match. Forget the handball. For me, that was a great moment. But maybe I'm slightly biased. But to me, it's got to be the miracle of Mendoza. It really has. Archibald's goal, just even now, it gives me joy.
I think for me, I want to get really to grips and see firsthand two of the great bits. So I would either want to be right behind the Anfield, right behind the goal, just so I can get a firsthand view on that punch. You know, which arm got there first. But equally, I'd quite like to be, if I could get a seat right behind Alan Ruff for the free kick with the outside of the boot, just to see the angle. It's just an extraordinary. I was absolutely bowled over by that free kick. Absolutely incredible. But really, it should be there for Gemmell's goal. But it's good to mix it up. Okay, we should leave it there. Stefan, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed that. It's been a trip down memory lane, and so many bright spots, so many just interesting, isn't it? And it's been great. So thanks for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
It's been great to have you on. Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you, Graham and Stefan. Yeah, thanks again. It's absolutely brilliant. I really love this football team that we talked about, and having your first-hand accounts as a youngster, getting behind them, have been absolutely wonderful to listen to. So thank you.
Yeah, it's been a really good one. That's all we've got time for this time. As a reminder, do subscribe to the podcast if you want to get a fresh episode every Thursday come to you into your inbox. But that's all we have time for now. You can, of course, contact us on our social channels at By Far The Greatest FC, or via myself and Jamie at Said and Done, and at Couch Pundito on what most people still know as Twitter. We'd love to know any recommendations of other teams that you'd like us to cover on this, and we'll speak again soon.